technology world. All right.
Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Franklin Tsiaka, Professor Emeritus of the Russian Language and Literature at Hamilton College in New York. And he is the curator of Artists for Ukraine, Transforming Ammo Boxes into Icons. It's at the Museum of Russian Icons right here in Clinton, Massachusetts, on view until February 13th, 2023. Franklin, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, and greetings to the audience.
This is a wild project, and it's really wonderful. It's beautiful, too. How did you come across this art?
Well, first, I need to give you a little bit about my background. My father's family is Sicilian, as you might guess from my last name. But my mother's family is Ukrainian. And so I've always been interested in Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian Orthodoxy. And my ending up studying Russian was due to a strange family quirk. My mother's parents actually emigrated from what was then the Russian Empire around 1912.
Oh, wow.
So they actually considered themselves Russian.
That's just before the revolution?
Yes, just before the revolution, just before World War I and before the Russian Revolution.
Okay.
So this was a part of what is now in Western Ukraine, but very close to the border of what was the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Wow.
And so the curious thing is that these people considered themselves Russians, maybe little Russians, you know, as that terminology of the time. And in fact, my grandfather served in the Imperial Guard. And so he was completely Russified. And when they came to this country, of course, they went to the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yep.
And that just solidified, you know, their association, ethnically speaking. And of course, when I started college, I thought I'm going to study that language.
I want to stop you right there, Frank, because I want to back up a little bit and see if I can. How did they react to the revolution? Did you ever find that out?
No, I honestly don't know.
That would be fascinating to me. But what?
I do know how they reacted to World War I. Initially, before Hitler really showed his true colors, they supported that move to destroy the Soviets, right? Because they were anti-communist, and so. But how they reacted to the Russian Revolution, I'm not entirely sure. I can only tell you that my grandmother had a small little portrait of Tsar Nicholas hanging on her wall.
Wow.
You know, for her entire life.
Wow.
And they bought into that system, which makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
I guess. Anyway, so when I started college, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to study this language. Enrolled in Russian courses, started studying Russian literature, expanded then to understanding that you needed to study some Russian history. I took courses with Father John Meyendorf, a very famous theologian, right, on the Orthodox Church, because we were raised in the Orthodox Church. And as time went on, more and more indication was that, in fact, they were not ethnic Russians. They were Ukrainians. The language was substantially different. And it was no small consternation to my mother when I told her one day, so like, you know, you're not Russian. Stop calling yourself Russian. You're Ukrainian, right?
Wow.
What finally convinced her was, this is back in the 70s, I was spent some time studying in the Soviet Union. And I met up with some of the siblings of my grandmother, right? And I asked them point blank. I said, "Do you consider yourselves Russian or Ukrainians?" They looked at me like I was nuts. I said, "We're Ukrainians. What are you talking about?" And so that explains how I came to dedicate my academic life to things Russian, but then obviously expanded into things Ukrainian once I learned that. Mm-hmm. And my interest in iconography, you know, in the art of the Orthodox Church.
But you also study Russian literature.
Yes.
Well, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later in the show.
Yeah.
Now, there are these three fascinating icons, and they're beautiful.
Right.
And they're by these two artists, Alexander Klimenko and Sofia Atlantova. And you're going to have to give me the correct
name. Yeah, so Alexander Klimenko
and Sofia
Atlantova, their husband and wife. They are an artistic team in Kyiv. They both studied at the what's called the Kyiv Shevchenko State Art School and National Academy of Art and Architecture, right? So they did, you know, some serious academic background. And they also work in book illustrating. Alexander is also a poet, art critic. So these people are pretty well established. And they were trained as iconographers, you know, traditional iconographers. But then, of course, the birth of this project, you know, that they call Buy an Icon, Save a Life, happened apparently just quite by accident. Alexander was chatting with some people, and in the presence of the room, there were some old ammunition boxes that had been brought from the front. He was talking to some soldiers and stuff. And he took a look at them, at these old ammo boxes, most of which had actually come from the Soviet period, from the Russian side, which were then just abandoned on the front lines. And when he looked at them, he realized that the structure of them was just like that of traditional icons, that these were slats of wood that then had braces on the back, right, to hold the slats together. And so he, you know, in this sort of moment of inspiration, thought, you know, I'm going to take those objects that come from the killing field, right, and turn them into icons. And so that's how. And then his wife joined.
Swords into plowshares. It's pretty amazing.
Exactly. Right. So that's why we're calling it transforming.
Now, did I read this correctly? That this started with the original Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014.
Yes.
A lot of people who don't keep a good ear to the international news don't realize that this is actually what we're going through right now. Is the second recent invasion.
Right. Well, it's not even a second. It's a continuation, right? It was a new assault on Ukraine, right? That happened earlier in February of this year, but the fighting has taken place since 2014, right? There's been fighting, you know, in those easternmost regions of Donbass, of that old industrial area, which is still under Russian control. And so the idea was, and now they originally were painting icons and selling them in order to support this mobile medical unit to serve the Eastern Front, right?
It's the first volunteer mobile hospital, right?
Right. Yeah, this Pirogov, you know, named after Pirogov. And so the decision was, you know, once they started painting on the fragments of icon of ammo boxes, right, it took on new impetus.
Wow.
Right, and became much more powerful statement, right, of sort of like the reaffirmation of life, if you will, or you know, if you want to look at it from a spiritual point of view, the reaffirmation of faith in humanity, right, on the detritus of the war field. And so it's become re-intensified after the February invasion. In fact, two of the icons that are in the exhibition were painted quite recently, right? So they come from this year. They were painted this year actually to commission, right, from the two loaners of those icons. The one icon of Christ that's painted on camouflage, right, is from 2018, I think it was. That's the one that I originally purchased.
It's called the Savior of Camouflage.
Savior on camouflage, they call it. Yeah. And so how I came to discover this, I was actually, I don't know, maybe some of the listeners had the opportunity to come to the Museum of Russian Icons a couple of years ago. I think it was 2018, 2019, when I curated an exhibition on the Rushniki. These are Ukrainian ritual cloths, right? I about 3 years ago or so, read that there was an exhibition of such cloths, right, at this wonderful Ukrainian museum attached to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of America in South Bound Brook, New Jersey. They've got a wonderful museum there, a cultural center, an education center, and they were doing an exhibition of somebody else's collection, right? The one at the Icon Museum was from my personal collection. And of course, I was curious to see, you know, what the competition was offering. And so made a trip out to New Jersey and happened upon, right, this second exhibition that they were hosting at the same time of these icons. And my eyes just popped open, you know, you saw, there must have been about 30 of them, right, displayed, you know, and some of them, you know, these very compelling. And then, of course, you start reading the story and you start talking to you know, to the curator there, right, about the history of this stuff. And it becomes, you know, a momentous kind of cultural, right, moment, right, when you discover these things. And so So the funny thing is, of course, they're all for sale. All these icons are offered for sale.
For a good reason. It's to support this mobile hospital. Yeah.
So yeah, that's a practical reason, and then the goal even of our small exhibition,
wow.
Right? Either for visitors to make either outright donations or actually to go onto the website and buy an icon if they want.
What website?
So you can find the link the link to this Peter Goff Center, right, is actually given out at the museum. I don't have it here.
Okay, all right.
Handy. Or you could go to the museum's website, and they will also have a link to it, right, to the Icon Museum website, and go onto current exhibitions, and you'll find a link so that you can get there. I'm obviously now retired since I'm emeritus, and happily so, I must say. And reached that stage in my life where, as a collector of my during my entire life, I decided I have to stop buying things. I can't keep acquiring. I have to start giving away. And so I resisted buying one, and resisted successfully about a year or two after I saw that exhibition in New Jersey. It just kept bugging me. I thought, no, I have to do it. I want to support that cause. You know, and so I actually.
Yeah, well, this is the. I have to say, Frank, this is not just like buying something for your own use and that's it.
Right.
This is buying for a reason and for a cause.
Right.
And so it's a different kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's buying for history, too. I mean,
yeah, no doubt.
And now when you stand in front of these icons, you're actually, for an American audience, right? It's the most visceral, you know, possibility of feeling, you know, something of the war front, you know, because you're in the presence of these objects, right, that have come from the battle zone. So anyway, I yielded. I bought one, and then just a couple of months ago, was chatting with the members of the collection committee of the Icon Museum, of which I'm a member, and we were thinking, you know, this might be a very good pop-up exhibition for the museum, right, in order to show the museum's support, right, for the Ukrainian cause, for Ukrainian sovereignty, right. And so I had my icon, and then two other members of the committee, Rua Donnelly, right, and Kathy,
we'll think of her name
basing,
later. Okay.
Basing on her last name, right? Manic decided that they would also purchase icons,
wow.
Right? And then loan them. So the three icons are on loan for this mini exhibition.
There's a whole bunch of things I want to talk to you about, but let's start talking about, because I always have to refresh people's memories when we talk about icons, because it's not an art cultural form. A cultural art form that people here are familiar with,
right? Yeah,
how are icons used in the Ukraine and in Russia?
Well, of course, these are objects of devotion.
So you would have them inside your house.
So you'd have them. So my grandmother, my in the house I grew up in, there were icons. If you are fond of saying prayers, you would do so in front of the icons.
Yep.
The conception is that, you know, the theological conception is that the icon itself represents a kind of interface with heaven, right? That in fact you can use it to communicate with the divine, right? And to that degree, one has to emphasize that one should not worship the icon board itself, you know, the tangible object, right? But to use it as a kind of meditation tool, right? To direct your prayers is the way that. Although in reality, of course, you know, many people actually do venerate and worship particular icons. Those are the ones considered miracle working icons. Right, have a very special following.
Now, the painting an icon, as you mentioned, that these two artists, Alexander and Sofia, mm-hmm. they had to go to school to learn how to paint them. And
right,
people
right.
looking at icons might think they look very Byzantine.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain sort of rules and regulations about painting icons, correct?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Those rules are weakening to a large degree in the modern world, in the contemporary world, which causes a kind of, among some believers, causes a kind of problem that is a painting that looks like an icon, is it really functional as an icon, right? And it's a conversation we have in the museum all the time.
That's fascinating.
Contemporary artists.
You mean it can look like an icon, but it doesn't do what an icon does. It's not the intermediary between you and the holy.
Yeah, but
wow.
my sense is if the believer is using that icon in a traditional sense, to my way of thinking, right, it's an icon. It still functions in that traditional formula.
Could you do modernist icons?
See, now you're really treading on.
Okay. But you're the person I want to have that conversation with.
Yeah.
Have there been people who have tried to breach that, like use completely different art styles?
Yes, there are. And in fact, it's very interesting. It's a kind of school of icon painting that is currently flourishing in Western Ukraine, especially in the city of Lviv, you know, the big city in the West. They have always been much more much more Western looking, right, and much more influenced by the cultural currents, right, that coming out of the Renaissance, right, and later periods. And they have developed a style of devotional painting, right, that really borders upon, you know, sort of abstraction.
Wow. Right,
producing very interesting stuff.
That's fascinating.
If people are interested in that, they can actually go to Facebook. There's an interesting Facebook page called Icon Art Contemporary Art Gallery, right, in Lviv. And they can get a look at some of these paintings. Whether, in fact, an individual wants to consider that icon an icon worthy of veneration,
This is what's so, you know, I've had many conversations with the Museum of Russian Icons, and for me, it's such a unique museum. It really is. Yeah. But I don't know any other museum that can have these kinds of discussions. Like, if you go to an art museum, it's a piece of art.
Right.
You go to an icon museum, is it functioning as an icon is a really complicated abstract question.
Absolutely. And it's an issue that confronts the museum all the time. Because, in fact, the Museum of Russian Icons really functions as an art museum, right?
But it also functions as a place of a space of veneration.
For some people, yes. You know, I've heard reports of, you know, certain icons, right, being venerated, right, in the museum context. Right. They are not presented the way icon would be presented in a church or even at home. The conception is very tricky. Whenever you start displaying religious art or art that was created for a religious context, and you pull it out and put it in a contemporary art museum, right? You run into problems. I mean,
and this is not just icons. This is starting to be brought up with all art, like, for instance, Hindu art at the Worcester Art Museum, and Buddhist art. You take it out of context, and it becomes like this weird art object, but it doesn't have it within the context of the culture. It's viewed completely differently.
Right. And so you get a very different perception.
Well, that's the role of the museum, though, is to explain that difference.
Right, and to teach people, you know. Right. But then also to appreciate the objects as worthy of admiration as high art, I think. Again, you know, this is my personal opinion, but.
Well, you know, this brings up about these three. Okay, they're painted on ammo boxes. So is it what an icon is painted on does it matter? Like, you could put paint an icon on a trash can lid.
So that's an interesting thought.
But I mean, could you? I mean,
one could. Would anyone accept that as a legitimate icon, though? I mean,
well, wait a minute. But they would accept an ammo box, because that seems contrary.
Well, so that's the question. That really is a question that we have to pose. Whether, in fact, these ammo box icons, right, can function in a religious context. In a sacred. And the only thing I could say to that is they have been displayed in churches throughout Ukraine. Whether people are venerating them in traditional manner, I don't know precisely, but I have the feeling that they are. So simply by practice, right, they could achieve the status of a traditional icon.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Franklin Siaka, Professor Emeritus of Russian Language and Literature at Hamilton College in New York. And he's the curator of this really interesting, it's a small exhibition of three pieces, but it's fascinating. Artists for Ukraine, Transforming Ammo Boxes into Icons. It's at the Museum of Russian Icons here in Clinton, on view until February 13th, 2023. Frank, this brings up the really, there's so many interesting questions, but I want to get at some technical things.
Mm-hmm.
Are there Ukrainian styles of icon painting versus Russian styles?
Yes, there are. Yes, there are. And it brings an interesting issue that the museum is trying to confront now with our new director. We have a new great director who I think you interviewed.
I interviewed him. Yeah, he's great.
Simon Morsink, who's really fantastic. And that is, so Gordon Langton, who was the founder of the museum, focused almost exclusively on Russian icons.
Right.
Because those were the contacts that he was making. He had a business in Russia, and that's where he discovered icons. He then expanded a little bit into collectings of Ethiopian icons. But, of course, the Eastern Christian world is huge and includes not only Russia, but Ukraine, Belarus.
Right.
And then, like, whole swaths of Eastern Europe, like Serbia, is Orthodox. Some parts of Poland, some parts of Slovakia, Bulgaria. And then you go to the Caucasus, you know, Georgia and Armenia, not to mention the Middle East, Syriac icons.
All of these different traditions, though, visually different?
And these are all different traditions, and wow. Specialists can actually distinguish, you know, the painting style, right, of these. Because, of course, it's based upon, like any style, it's based upon other influences, other cultural influences. So to answer your original question, you know, so there are some distinct schools of Ukrainian icon painting, especially in the westernmost regions, where they weren't hindered by the influence of the Russian Church. A lot of icons that we understand now that are in the icon museum that are identified as Russian are actually probably Ukrainian. That is to say, they're painted on what is now Ukrainian territory, right? But it raises that other issue of if you're painting in a Russian academic style, which many icons are, right? Even though it's painted on Ukrainian territory, is that Ukrainian? Is that Russian?
Wait a minute. Is the Ukrainian Orthodox Church different from the Russian Orthodox Church?
Now that's a can of worms.
And I can see that. I mean, this is the other exciting thing about the Museum of Russian Icons, is it's smack dab in the middle of a huge international situation.
Right, exactly.
You must have Russian patrons who are furious about this.
I would think so. Although apparently I've talked to the people at the museum. The initial reaction to this Amelbox icons is very positive. Right?
Oh yeah,
people are very moved by.
Oh yeah, I think I think they're fascinating and beautiful, and from a conceptual point of view and a meaningful point of view. I think they're strong pieces.
They really are. And I think the way they display them is really dramatic.
Yeah.
You know, the three of them in that darkened room. When listeners hopefully go and visit the show, I want to urge them to walk around the icons so they go they can examine the backs of them and take a look at the construction, right, of the ammo boxes. You get a much better sense from the back, right, that these are ripped off of, you know, old wooden boxes. And then they've actually inserted a small image of what a traditional icon is constructed, looking at the back of a traditional icon, and you see the similarities. You'll get a sense of why Alexander was so correct in immediately identifying.
Well, they're traditionally painted on wood, right?
Traditionally painted on wood, although they can be cast in bronze and brass.
Yep.
There are other types of icons. Sometimes in some regions they paint it on shells. Right, or they can carve them in wood, although it's not very typical for Orthodox worship. But there are some saints who are typically carved, and there's some good examples of that in the Icon Museum collection.
Wow!
When you think of a traditional icon, right, from Byzantine days, right, you think of painting on wood and done according to, you know, very strict traditions of how the wood is prepared, how they lay down a gesso ground. The layering of the different paints. And this, of course, all comes from Byzantium, right? Or at least among the Eastern. Well, no, I would think it's fair to say that the whole tradition of icon painting is ultimately, you know, derived from Byzantine painting styles.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, before we're almost out of time. Yeah, I know. Have you heard from Alexander and Sophia about what it's, they're still trying to work as artists in the Ukraine right now?
Yes, yes. And so they're still painting icons. They're still working. I haven't spoken with them directly. I actually worked through a woman who is involved with the medical mobile medical unit, right? She's the one who sort of deals with the sale of the icons, right? And so she's been the intermediary.
And they've, by the way, these have raised an amazing amount of money. It's a huge amount of money that they've raised for this mobile unit.
I think at this point now, upwards of $500,000.
Right.
From what I understand, and hopefully we'll continue to raise money as they continue to display them, right, and continue to paint.
Could I ask you how you think this whole thing is going to end?
There's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I'm really, of course, worried now about the upcoming winter.
Yep.
Putin's deliberate desire to terrorize, right, the Ukrainian people, which is just backfire, as far as I can see, is backfiring, on them.
You know, this last missile barrage was just horrific.
Yeah, yeah, and so it's a deliberate terrorism. I mean, it's terrorism, right? Act to try and make them submit, right, or freeze to death, right? But hopefully, you keep hearing, you know, that certain electric grids, you know, have been bombed out of existence, but they make very quick strides in sort of replacing it as best as they're able to, right, under these conditions. It's going to be a long, hard winter for the Ukrainian people. There's no doubt about it. And I recently read some plans that they're actually going to encourage some people, the Ukrainian government will encourage certain Ukrainian people in certain regions to actually evacuate for the time being, right?
For the winter.
So they don't perish in the cold.
Would they try to cross borders up into Poland or something like that?
They could continue to do that. I mean, Poland, of course, has been so good. The people of Poland, I actually have a very good Polish friend who I spoke with just after the February invasion, right? And she was just glowing over, you know, how wonderful the Ukrainian people are and how they need to help them, right? Because they are, in fact, the first line of defense.
That's right.
Right, of NATO Europe.
On that note, we're completely out of time. And I hope a lot of people come and see this show. My guest tonight has been Franklin Sciarca, professor emeritus of Russian language and literature at Hamilton College in New York. And he's the curator of a little, it's only three pieces, but they're fascinating. Artists for Ukraine, transforming ammo boxes into icons at the Museum of Russian Icons in Clinton, Massachusetts, on view until February 13th, 2023. Frank, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, Mark Ditto, it's been a real pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.